Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear a talk by Matthew Crosten, professor of political science at Bellevue University, Miller Endowed Chair for Industrial and International Security, and director of the International Security and Intelligence Studies Program at Bellevue University. He'll speak on the topic Thad, Mad, Bad, the Battle of Competing Narratives Over the South China Sea. This program, part of the 12th Annual Asian Culture Week, co-sponsored by Creighton's Asian World Center, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday afternoon, April 19, 2016, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Maorang Jiang, the director of the Asian World Center at Creighton University.
Dr. Matthew Crosten, professor of political science at Bellevue University, is the Miller Endowed Chair for Industry and International Security and director of the International Security and Intelligence Studies Program. He has authored two well-received books, several book chapters, and over two dozen peer-reviewed articles in venues like the International Journal of Intelligence and Counterintelligence, Journal of Strategic Security, International Politics, Journal of Military and Strategic Affairs, Comparative Strategy, Journal of Conflict Transformation and Security, Strategic Studies Quarterly, Central Asian Survey, Journal of Global Analysis and Democracy and Security. His research agenda continues to address counterterrorism, intelligence analysis, and education, failed democratization, global gender violence, and cyber war ethics. His works have been translated into Russian, Arabic, Chinese, Hebrew, Spanish, Turkish, Farsi, Greek, and Uzbek. In 2015, Professor Crosten won the Bellevue All-Faculty Research Prize for Outstanding Scholarship, and in 2013 was named the Outstanding Instructor by the International Association for Intelligence Education, while also receiving the Commander's Coin for Integrity, Service, and Excellency from the 97th Intelligence Squadron for facilitating foreign language studies for airmen at Offutt Air Force Base in Omaha. In the past few years, he has been invited to speak at such diverse venues such as the U.S. Department of State, the Defense Intelligence Agency, Oxford University, and University College London, as well as being asked to give interviews for Japanese, Chinese, Russian, Iranian, and Saudi news services. He has a BA from Colgate University, MA from the University of London, PhD from Brown University, and finished a postdoctoral fellowship at the University of Toronto. Thank you very much again. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Crosten for his talk.
As always, the only problem with introductions like that is you have to live up to the billing. So hopefully I will do that. I'd like to thank, first of all, in general, Creighton University and my dear friend Maorang and the Asian World Center for inviting me here today to talk about this issue that I consider to be, as we like to say, critically crucial, but yet is also still somewhat, in my opinion, underemphasized and is certainly little known amongst general Western audiences, most certainly amongst general American audiences. To explain a little bit of how I got first associated with this topic, I suppose I should just begin at the beginning, which is roughly 3 to 4 months ago. I was sort of out of the blue contacted by a rather large Chinese news agency conglomerate, asking if I would be willing to submit to. As an intelligence professor, I always found that sort of, I'm sure it was just an issue of translating language differences, but I always loved the fact that I was asked if I would be willing to submit to an interview by this Chinese news agency, which of course I was enthusiastic to do, readily agreed. I was told that I would have a chance to just talk at least about general Chinese-American relations and perhaps touch upon a few specific topics that cross my general areas of interest in terms of research. And so then I waited, and I waited, and I waited some more. And in the midst of this disappearing, suddenly, approximately about a month ago, I received in my email inbox the following, and I quote, "As we know, North Korea conducted a nuclear test and a missile test under the guise of a peaceful satellite launch, which pressed the United States, along with its key regional allies, South Korea and Japan, into recalibrating Washington's failed policy, of so-called strategic patience with Pyongyang. Concerns about North Korea's aggressive behavior, coupled with inefficient responses, has meant that America now plans to deploy THAAD, Advanced Anti-Missile Shield, to South Korea. It seems that America's movement is reaction instead of action. China does understand, remember, this is the interview. China does understand that the deployment of THAAD is to protect South Korea and counter North Korea's nuclear threat. However, China and Russia hold that a THAAD deployment exceeds South Korea's actual defense needs and directly damages China and Russia's strategic security interests, as well as breaking the regional strategic balance. What's your personal interest in this and opinion on this problem? And do you think China and Russia's concerns are reasonable?" And that, ladies and gentlemen, was the entirety of my interview with the Chinese News Service. This single, long, declaratory, almost accusatory paragraph, and then really ostensibly one question, which, if I'm being honest with all of you, probably from the side of the interviewer, was probably actually a rhetorical question. But nevertheless, it isn't rhetorical to me. And as any good, upstanding international security and intelligence professor should do, my initial response to reading this was, of course, what is THAAD? And why is this thing that maybe I've heard in passing over time, but never really had much of an emphasis or focus on from any side or any corner, why is it holding such attention by the Chinese, and why is it of such great concern? Well, THAAD stands for Terminal High Altitude Area Defense. What it does, or at least as I was sort of amazingly told by a precocious daughter of a colleague when she overheard us talking about this issue not that long ago, it's something that likes to bang into things in the air and make them go boom. And I was like, you silly, chilly child, silly, naive. Actually, it kind of does do that. That is actually its purpose. But if you want to be a little bit more technical, it is a United States Army anti-ballistic missile system designed to shoot down short, medium, and intermediate ballistic missiles in their terminal phase using a hit-to-kill approach. The missiles of THAAD carry no warheads, but they rely instead on the kinetic energy of the impact to destroy the incoming missile. A kinetic energy hit minimizes the risk of exploding conventional warhead ballistic missiles, and nuclear-tipped ballistic missiles will not explode upon a kinetic energy hit, at least through THAAD. Although it is true that chemical and biological warheads may disintegrate or explode and pose a risk of containment to the environment wherever they happen to detonate. That's a short technical background of what THAAD represents. The sort of logistical, geographical journey of THAAD is maybe, to me, a little bit more interesting. In 2009, THAAD was actually deployed on the island of Hawaii. In 2013, THAAD was deployed on the island of Guam. And right now, as we sit here with all of you, the Pentagon is actually speaking with South Korea, engaging in talks to see if it will agree to have THAAD be deployed on the peninsula in 2016. So what we have here is clearly, at least from the perspective, in my opinion, of the Chinese side, is what can we call creeping THAADism from east to west from the Chinese perspective. We have these interpretations of what that might mean. Now, China has always warned against this U.S. plan in the past, and even South Korea has always somewhat been noncommittal about the deployment of THAAD on the peninsula within its own territories. Brian McKeon, who currently serves as the Principal Deputy Undersecretary of Defense for Policy at the Pentagon, that's even more than my title, when asked by Senator Angus King, who was independent from Maine, if there had been any reaction from China in terms of this possible deployment, he replied, well, they are not happy about it, but it's not about China. It's not a threat to China. And we have made that plain to them and offered to explain it to them. This is going to be a running theme throughout this talk today for all of you, which is always to pay attention to the words that people say and scratch the surface underneath that sort of superficial, shallow level of interpretation and see what you can find underneath, because that's always where I find the most fascinating things. And two areas of that one simple sentence declaration from McKeon. One, I find it two completely different things. You have made it plain to them, and we have offered to explain it to them. I don't know which one that is, really, because I think if you've already made it plain to them, you would have already explained it. But if you're offering to explain it, then it might mean that it's not been made plain to the Chinese. Perhaps even more importantly was this concept that the United States has declared this is not about China deploying THAAD to South Korea, and it's not a threat to China. There's, I'm sure in this room, I can certainly see faces that are very much into this aspect of global affairs, foreign policy, diplomatic and war studies. How many people remember towards the end of the second term of George W. Bush, and it became a major issue in the first beginning year of the Obama presidency, there was another missile defense system that made the news quite a bit, in which we were discussing placing rockets in Poland and the Czech Republic. I see lots of heads shaking. Yes, good. Now, this brilliant plan was obviously to protect Europe from an impending attack of doom from who? Right. We said it was for, I heard some people actually mouth the words, Russia. But we actually said it was stopping the threatening impending attack on Europe from Iran. So we were putting rockets in Poland and in the Czech Republic to stop that menacing, marauding attacker from Iran heading towards Western Europe. To which the Russians always said, yeah, right. I don't think we believe that. And even if you think it does serve a purpose for deterring an attack from Iran, we have a sneaking suspicion that it might also be rather effective in deterring or intimidating certain approaches or initiatives from Russia. Because we believe in the duality of things and multitasking in the military, even though you apparently do not. So one of the first things Obama did when he came to office was actually scrap that plan simply because he felt maybe the PR value of it in and of itself just wasn't an easy sell and it wasn't going anywhere, so he dumped it. But this same situation, here we are now, 8 years later, and it's the same argument. I'm fascinated by the same argument that we're putting this missile defense system in South Korea after having put it first on Hawaii, then we put it in Guam. Now we want it in South Korea. But it has nothing to do with you, China. You just ignore this. There's nothing to see here. China, again, just like its compatriots in Russia, would probably have just simply said, yes, of course, right. I'm sure there's no duality of this at all. So being able to parse, but the fact is, if you listen to the actual quote from McKeon when he says it, it's completely straight. And it sounds believable if you don't scratch the surface of what he's saying and dig deeper into the sort of the not-so-hidden subtext meaning. One of the problems that the United States, I find, has with many of its positions is that it makes statements like that, and I've gone on a personal journey on this, intellectually speaking, over the years, where I wanted to believe, being with my intelligence background, this was just some sort of deep psychological insidious maneuver to manipulate people's minds. And then I got closer to with people in D.C. and realized their minds don't really work that insidiously or deviously or that manipulatively. My great image of Bond villains has not been fulfilled. But we still make these comments and we make these statements. And the problem I have, given what we do, is the fact that you make statements that you seem to maybe believe, But you're not taking into account the fact that no one else in the world, as far as I can tell, believes you. They just let you speak, and then they walk away and sort of chuckle behind their backs at how silly we tend to be when we make statements like that. So I wish, there's part of me that wishes we would stop, especially when in, as you'll see going on in this talk, both on the sides of at least Russia and China, and now increasingly after the JCPOA with Iran, we're almost getting more straight talk with some of these issues from the quote-unquote adversaries than we do necessarily from the formal diplomatic musings of our own country. And that, to me, can't be anything but bad news. The backstory of THAAD, that's sort of the geographical, logistical evolution of THAAD. The backstory of it is that the United States has always wanted South Korea and Japan to deepen military cooperation. I'm afraid not so much because they think it's just a great thing for peace and that's what they really want, but it helps facilitate the United States' own position of rebalancing toward Asia. The amusing thing, it's almost to me a little bit of a Monty Python sketch. I'm probably dating myself, if anyone still remembers Monty Python. There are still so many territorial, historical, and sort of cultural disputes or potential hostility between Seoul and Tokyo that our effort, this great American effort to bring these two people together and have them face each other and realize they should be in collaborative efforts against a bigger issue or a bigger rival, has only made them dawn and made it sort of look at each other and realize, oh yes, I don't really like you. Get out of my face. And there goes our rebalancing toward Asia through new cooperative alliances from these regional partners. But since Washington still always wants to deter North Korea and use the U.S.-South Korea alliance to counter China, it's always been against our interest to see better Chinese-South Korean relations. We've not wanted that because we've worried that that would actually maybe undermine the cornerstone of the U.S. rebalancing strategy. It might not necessarily undermine regional peace, but it undermines our strategy. So it puts us in a sort of delicate position of where our priorities are supposed to be. And so we often end up taking countermeasures. How we've used THAAD as a system has been one of those primary countermeasures. It is definitely designed to counter Pyongyang's nuclear and missile threat, but it isn't harmful to us, or it doesn't damage our ideas or our thoughts at all, that it might also somewhat weaken the strategic deterrence of China and Russia. So Washington, over the years, has always released deployment rumors about THAAD and to see what would play out as a consequence of it, hoping it would serve our purposes without having to go through the logistical nightmare of actually deploying this thing. But as things have churned up, which is what gets us to the real backstory of today's talk, which is the South China Sea. When you're trying to understand why we do this with THAAD or where we might do it, you understand that there's competing backstories and competing narratives within the South China Sea. Obviously, there's a Chinese side. Obviously, there's an American side. But we'll also at least briefly cover a third local side that counters the Chinese. On the first side, the American side. For the past 2 years, China has been, this is the official position that we carry. For the past 2 years, China has been constructing 7 artificial islands and at least 3 airstrips in the South China Sea, despite protests from its neighbors, and has refused to take part in legal arbitration that was initiated in 2013 by the Philippines at a UN-backed tribunal in The Hague, the Netherlands. Chinese officials have repeatedly asserted that China's right to reclaim land within its own sovereign territory is sacrosanct, and it's also warned that the U.S. should, quite frankly, keep out of its territorial disputes. It's really none of its business. President Barack Obama has said on numerous occasions, and again, this is a hint about scratching under the surface of not-so-hidden subtextual meanings, that China is, quote, using its sheer size and muscle to force countries into a subordinate position. And just because the Philippines and Vietnam are not as large as China doesn't mean that they can just be elbowed aside. To continue, growing alarm about China's aggressive activities in the South China Sea is provoking an unprecedented military buildup in the region. That's from the commander of the Pacific Fleet's U.S. Pacific Fleet, Admiral Scott Swift, and he said this is Chinese disruptive activities in contested waters causes widespread anxiety in the Indo-Pacific region, and we're very concerned that China has a lack of transparency about its behavior. What are its intentions? What does it really want to do with all these maneuvers? It's not letting us know. Shocking. That it's making other Asia-Pacific nations respond by spending more on their own military buildup. There's another moment. Who is at least a primary player in the military buildup of these South China Sea neighbors? The United States. So I'm always fascinated when, out of one side of my mouth, I can say, this is something we really have to be concerned about. It's very destructive and very damaging that there's a military buildup taking place in this region. Well, who's doing that military? Well, we're kind of selling it to them. But don't worry about that. Let's just focus on the priority here. We do both of that quite a bit. And we'll come to this at the end. Please know that, given my position, this is not an anti-American speech. One of the wonderful things I love about intelligence studies, and which helped me sort of hasten my march from traditional international relations, traditional comparative politics, was the fact that in intelligence studies, we are the worst, meaning the best, Machiavellians, in that we're not immoral, we are amoral. Right? Our job is simply to determine what's going on and figure out what the consequences are and who it impacts and who's motivated to do what and where their priorities are. It is not our job to decide right or wrong, who wears the white hat versus who wears the black hat, who's the good cowboy versus who's the bad cowboy. That's never been our job. And I really love it, actually, because I've come across other disciplines, they shall remain nameless, where there is a very strong sense of moral indignation with a lot of the research we conduct. And I think sometimes it sets discussions and debates across diverse audiences and diverse countries, it sets it back. So there's a little plug for intelligence studies if any of you are interested in graduate school. In February, the head of the U.S. military's Pacific Command said China is clearly militarizing the South China Sea. Admiral Harry Harris said, you'd have to believe in a flat earth to believe otherwise. So there's a nutshell. That's the sum up of the American side of the South China Sea backstory. The Chinese side is equally interesting to me. U.S. forces will soon have access to at least 5 military bases in the Philippines. Some are strategically positioned in the disputed South China Sea area. This is also part of a larger plan where the Chinese have seen new U.S. military deployments to both Australia and Singapore and have been already long underway. The Philippines itself is locked in a dispute with China over the South China Sea, parts of which are also claimed, but they never get, speaking of Obama's comment about just because you're small and not overly powerful, you shouldn't be elbowed aside. Well, Brunei, Malaysia, Taiwan, and Vietnam all also have claims in the South China Sea. Apparently, they can be elbowed aside, even by us. Manila has been encouraging, and maybe the reason the Philippines play has gotten more attention is because the Philippines have been the one playing up the most as far as U.S. activism in the region. The Philippines are the ones who want the U.S. in the region the most, and they want an active role in resisting what it regards as Chinese aggression in Philippine waters. In the South China Sea disputes, however, China feels just as strongly that it is the victim, because it has never, according to it, it has never seized a single islet in the waters from others, whereas countries such as the Philippines and Vietnam have occupied Chinese islands and islets for years. China has pressed Japan as well to not broach Beijing's disputes with regional neighbors at the upcoming Group of Seven summit, which will be taking place in Japan in May, and arguing that touching on that issue would hamper efforts to improve bilateral relations. That's what their diplomatic sources say. What I find fascinating, again, is that subtext, that contextual subtext. We just mentioned that one of the main parts of the United States' position is that it absolutely wants to disrupt bilateral relations if those bilateral relations are between China and other members are in and around the South China Sea. Because if there's going to be a huge global power anchor in any bilateral relations within the South China Sea, the United States wants that anchor to be itself. And it does not want it to be China. So there's this really interesting thing that I am absolutely convinced Japan, on a diplomatic thing in back channels, is definitely receiving sort of open pressure from China in terms of the Group of Seven summit in May. Don't do this. Where on back channels, I can guarantee you Japan is receiving pressure from the United States to do that. Please do that. Bring that up at the Group of Seven summit in May. You really must. We really want you to. So what Japan does will be really, really interesting to see where their allegiances or where they think their future lies in terms of the South China Sea between these two powers, which leads us as a perfect segue into that third, less appreciated backstory of the South China Sea, which I consider to just be sort of a less rigid, more interesting counter of the Chinese side on the locals. When China told the Group of Seven last week, to butt out, basically, of its territorial disputes and its controversial maritime claims, China's basically, to them, has sort of doubled down on what is an historic strategic blunder. Beijing's quote-unquote belligerence is especially imprudent, and by refusing to compromise on its outrageous, again, language, sovereignty claims, the government of China is discrediting its own quote-unquote peaceful rise plan in terms of global politics, and it also complicates the efforts of other member states of ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, to triangulate between China and the United States. Remember that word, triangulate. Continued Chinese muscle flexing will only undermine support for the Chinese president's signature new One Belt, One Road initiative, which is in and of itself a different topic, but really, really fascinating. And it will push regional fence sitters supposedly into the U.S. embrace. So this will all be backfiring against China, according to them. So the most promising outcome for all concerned would be a face-saving climb down by China. But to go back to that issue of what you're doing will hinder efforts to triangulate between China and the United States. What does that actually mean, triangulate? We love that word in intelligence studies. We think it's very sexy. But what it really ostensibly means in real terms is I want to play you, big bad neighbor right in my own neighborhood, against you, big bad not neighbor who still sticks his nose in my business in my neighborhood all the time anyway. Why do I do this? I do this because I want to actually have some of my own agenda, some of my own interests, some of my own needs met. And I don't think either one of you are really out for us. I don't think the United States and China care about Vietnam or Filipina or Filipino interests or South Korean interests. I think they care about their own interests first. And if along the way some of our interests can be met along with it, fine. Excellent. Wonderful. But you won't prioritize us. So we're going to triangulate you to offer to sort of battle you one off of the other and get our interests met that way. Not surprisingly, I'm not sure either China or the United States is really enthusiastic about being triangulated. So there's this always this, so we have that these angles. We don't want bilateral relations with China. We want it with us. No, well, we don't want it with the U.S. We want it with China. We don't want triangulation. Yes, we do want triangulation. These are the backstories and the sort of what I've called basically this my international Scooby-Doo mystery, in that there's all these jagged jigsaw puzzles that I think fit together into a single picture. But I'm not entirely sure it's the same picture, and I'm still not even sure if all the pieces are there. But I'm still going to try and jam it all together and see what comes out. Because every side seems to have a different context and a different perspective and different angles, while all of them speak to the greater good of global security and peace and collaboration. That's the backstories of the South China Sea feeding out of the backstory of THAAD. There's still an American angle to address with this, though. For those who might be aware, there's sort of an increasingly important and influential sort of open digital commentary site called War on the Rocks, in which there was a recent piece that argued that U.S. policymakers and military planners needed to think about how to prepare for the next quote-unquote big war. In their essay, these authors' essays identified six gaps: munitions, weapons platforms, manpower, planning, technology, stamina, that a big war against a quote-unquote peer competitor could reveal weaknesses and problems. So it was ultimately a call for the United States to improve its planning for mobilization. Again, scratching that surface, the contextual meaning, the hidden meaning inside of these subtexts, what is the next big war? Now, nowhere in this article was China ever mentioned in specifics. And while Russia does its absolute very best, I always find it fascinating, the comparison between China and Russia has always interested me. They've always been my two great research loves. But Russia is always the one that kind of is the Kardashian of global affairs. And I think I'll stop there before I associate China with some other actress. I was going to say Gwyneth Paltrow, but that might not work. The issue is that Russia wants to be famous to be famous, right? It just digs it. You just can't avoid the fact that it loves the limelight. It thinks it deserves the limelight and doesn't want anyone else to have a hotter spotlight than it. China is really not that way, while still wanting the same prestige and respect and power that it feels it should be rightly afforded. So while Russia wants to believe that the next big war and the great peer competitor is it really, right now at least, isn't, despite its own best efforts of being that. Not as long as China is still here. So the funny thing is this article, which was supposedly just purely theoretical, purely philosophical, we're just sort of having a thought experiment, intellectual journey, if you will, never mentioned China by name. There is no way you'll ever convince me that China didn't read that article and think, this is nothing except about China. We are the next big rival. The big war is with us. We are the peer competitor. And if we didn't need, if we weren't going to find direct, explicit confirmation within that article, soon after that article, Miss Amy Seawright, who is the Deputy Secretary of Defense, it's amazing to me how many bureaucrats we actually have with titles, the Deputy Secretary of Defense for South and Southeast Asia, told reporters at the opening session of the U.S.-Philippine Bilateral Security Dialogue that the U.S. DOD, the Department of Defense, had already submitted notification to Congress that it is preparing to roll out a new maritime capacity-building initiative for Southeast Asian states near the South China Sea. Now, those were a lot of words sort of grouped together in military speak, but what it really meant is we now had a diplomatic communique that seemed to basically be an explicit affirmation of the purely intellectual journey that the previous authors had taken on War on the Rocks. If we need to mobilize and plan better mobilization across a whole host of identified military gaps, and then the Deputy Secretary of Defense for South and Southeast Asia comes out and says soon after, we have just such a mobilization plan for the South China Sea, you can see where there would be an instinctive concern or consternation from the Chinese side. That what did we do to deserve this? Why are you focusing on us? What's going on? And sure enough, in another purely intellectual, quote-unquote, thought experiment, China has come out, the Chinese president has come out calling for his country that it needs to get serious about innovation, not just to buoy its faltering economy, but that the People's Liberation Army needs to bring military R&D back under its oversight. And in order to do that, they're going to launch a new agency modeled after the United States Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. This reminds me of SHIELD, for people who like Marvel Comics and watch the show. No one ever remembers what SHIELD stands for, but it's kind of a cool acronym, so it works. That's DARPA. Has anyone heard of DARPA? DARPA is the very uninspired Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency. It's kind of like being a college student writing your thesis and you title it paper. But DARPA, if you want to know what DARPA is, for those who don't, DARPA to me is the closest thing we have is if Tony Stark was real and Stark Industries was real, DARPA is maybe the closest thing governmentally, militarily we have that would modify or come close to being that as an analogy. You know, the fascinating whiz-bang gadgets and gadgets and whatchamacallits that we come up with for fighting the future war, more often than not, come out of projects that are funded and supported by DARPA. So China, sequentially, has decided after first that theoretical argument about needing how to prepare for the next big war against the next peer competitor, and then having the Undersecretary of Defense say that, ooh, we're doing just that, and we're going to put it right in the South China Sea. Now suddenly they need a DARPA to have Stark against Stark, America versus China. All of this comes in with, again, what's exactly happening? And I can't exactly, I'd like to be able to always admit that in intelligence studies, we intelligence people are the bastions of high moral code and honesty, but we're not. And in a recent interview that was actually conducted by Senator McCain with the Director of National Intelligence, DNI Clapper, wanting to assess what China was doing in and around the South China Sea, he admitted that there's definitely the establishment of what would be considered defensive capabilities by China all across the South China Sea in areas that it considers to be its own territorial waters and territorial assets, but that it's still militarizing these disputes because, again, we are worried about the fact that China might be able to multitask some of these defensive capabilities, which, again, scratching that surface, that running theme for us, it's funny how what we say can't be multitasked, but yet we can use that same argument to criticize the Chinese. That, well, yes, for most of the things we've seen being built on these artificial islands and in the islets seem to be defensive in nature, but we're still worried that they might turn some of these defensive things over into offensive things. Well, that was what the Chinese was arguing about THAAD, with which we began with, and which our great, profound intellectual response was, it's not about you, China. Just be quiet. And funnily, that doesn't really work as a response to get China to be quiet. The retort, though, the official response from China to the issues brought up by DNI Clapper to Senator McCain, was that they've taken aim at the United States over this criticism. Whether we're declaring this air defense identification zone over the East China Sea or building these artificial islands in the South China Sea, Washington has always considered such actions violations of international norms, a violation of international law. And as a result, it's resumed its own freedom of navigation patrols in the Western Pacific last year. China considers Washington's reaction to be sort of the typical hypocritical, right? Typical hypocritical. How, Chinese officials ask, can the United States criticize China for militarizing the South China Sea when it uses military forces to conduct its freedom of navigation patrols near Chinese-held islets and has expanded its Asian military alliances, most notably through the expanded defense cooperation agreement with the Philippines? Cut back to that little comment about international norms, the violation of international law. How many people believe in international law and feel that it's important? All right, so a few people at the front table of very distinguished guests are going to be really unhappy in a second. The way I always like to, and this is, I'm waiting for the moment when I realize how old I'm actually getting, when this movie reference is going to date me and people will just stare back at me like I have no idea what you're talking about. But how many people remember the first movie in the Pirates of the Caribbean series? So The Curse of the Black Pearl. Now, there's a moment in The Curse of the Black Pearl where Elizabeth, played by Keira Knightley, is brought on board after asking for the right of parley to talk directly with Captain Barbossa. And his mean, nasty pirates who were about to do mean, nasty things to Elizabeth had to stop and bring her on board the Black Pearl because it's the pirate's code and you must honor the code. And parley means you have to immediately take them in front of the captain and have a mutual, interactive, co-equal debate and discussion with the captain of the ship. So they bring her on board, and she is subsequently horrified to find out that this discussion is not going anywhere near as well as she thought it was going to go, and Captain Barbossa doesn't seem all that interested in honoring her request whatsoever when she's on board. And she challenges him, accusing him, "What about your famous pirate's code?" To which he basically responds, and I paraphrase, no offense, Jeffrey Rush, first, you're not a pirate. And second, the code is really more like guidelines. This is how I teach my students what I consider international law to be. That when countries like China and the United States come forward and have discussions about international law, I'm always tempted to find them sort of saying, well, first, to other countries. First, you're not China or the United States. And second, international law is kind of like guidelines. We like to follow them. Sometimes it really doesn't behoove us to follow them, and when that happens, we tend to not follow them. And honestly, so far, we haven't had much damage come out to us from not following them in these moments, so I think you should quite frankly be happy that we follow them at all. So that's somewhat of the backstory of how China reacts when the Americans sort of try to preach to them about honoring international law and the sanctity of international norms. Which leads us ultimately, we have plenty of time for question and answers. There are five key questions that I think we should all be thinking about, and I would like you to think about as you leave here today after this talk. First, who has the right to project power? To me, underneath all of this, from THAAD to the South China Sea, to Japan, to South Korea, to the Philippines, to Vietnam, to the United States, to China, and back to China, this is really a discussion about power and who has the right to project it, and whether there's particular ways in which that projection is okay to do and other ways in which it is not. But there is a fundamental debate and discussion right now between China and the United States, which they are not actually having. It's just reading between the lines they're actually having it without talking about it at all, about whether or not China has the right to project its power in any way it sees fit or any way it seems that it can get away with, and the United States saying, no, you cannot, even though you might think we do that ourselves. Second question, is there always a duty to maintain status quo? When you read the American responses involving the South China Sea, you'll come across that word quite a bit, status quo, maintaining the status quo. The Chinese should not be allowed to alter the status quo. Where I sit and in the field that I'm in, we're usually put into teams, red teams, if you will, to try and ask these questions about, well, why? What is it suddenly that has made the status quo sanctified? If the status quo is nothing except an examination or an assessment of the now, who has the right to suddenly say there is some sort of immutability about the now that should never be changed? I'm not sure how well the United States itself measures up to that very standard about honoring the status quo and the immutability of the now, meaning you cannot make a change to it. But it seems to be saying that about China, that it cannot make a change to the status quo. And really, if we want to be cynical, I suppose they would say and come back, it's because the status quo right now benefits you, and therefore you find it immutable, which is exactly why it's mutable to us. Because it is, after all, I wish someone would, too. I haven't heard anyone do this yet, but I would love to have someone in China come up to the mic and just simply say, it is called the South China Sea. Would you please, United States, at least acknowledge that? Wherever we go from there, who knows? But at least let's step to the mic and do that. Third, what is the obligation of a regional hegemon in terms of behavior? And this question has far-reaching consequences to me. Russia most certainly would like to know the answer to this question, or what we feel the debate and discussion would be on this. Saudi Arabia and Iran are right now duking it out quite literally on what this means in the greater Middle East. Nigeria, I think, would be fairly interested in the answer to this question. Brazil and Venezuela would be interested in the answer to this question. And most certainly, finally, what we're here for today, China should be very interested in the answer to this question. What is the obligation of a regional hegemon in terms of behavior? Is it just simply, we are the biggest and baddest and the most obvious leader of this region, so therefore we do as we please? And classic sports analogy, if you don't want me to do that, stop me from doing it. Otherwise, go sit down. Now, is that really the standard of behavior we want to have? And if that isn't the standard of behavior, what is the standard behavior supposed to be? The problem, as I see it, though, is the fact that the United States, while still easily being the quote-unquote lone global superpower, and I think we overestimated what that would actually mean in terms of our influence and our abilities to project power, while still being the lone global superpower, it has also seemed remarkably uncomfortable with even allowing the emergence of a regional hegemonic network. Meaning, we're not even saying we're not going to allow China to elevate to our level or let Russia return back to our level or let some unknown like Saudi Arabia or Iran or Venezuela or Brazil rise up eventually to that level. We're not even letting you get to that. We're down at the middle layer of regional hegemony, and we're protesting even that. And that's why they get so much pushback, I believe, honestly, why the United States gets so much pushback and so much blowback on that, because it just seems, for those regional leaders, patently unfair. Fourth question. Is there truly fair and balanced solutions to these problems, Or does every side literally have a biased angle? And again, this is one of the fun things. When you're in international relations and comparative politics, I think we often try to find those completely objective, completely fair and balanced theoretical perspectives. And in intelligence, I have to admit, I felt wonderfully unhandcuffed when you do research within intelligence, because we don't have to care about it at all. In fact, what we usually care about more is, please give me the bias. Please let me have access to the information to know what the bias is, where the prejudice lies, where the cultural slants and slights happen to be, because we think that powers a lot of decision-making more than we like to let on. And so our sort of dry, hardcore, objective analyses don't necessarily hit the mark as much as our subjective ones. And then finally, and maybe the most important one for our talk today, must a powerful and dominant China mean belligerence? So far, if again we're just simply taking the evidence of how all the sides in question have reacted to maneuvers, reacted to initiatives, it seems to be the answer from them is that, yes, we don't trust a powerful and dominant China. We assume automatically that any initiatives and any maneuvers will ultimately work out to be belligerent, even if we don't necessarily see that belligerence playing out in explicit forms right now. This, to me, I think, leads really fascinating discussions to open up for this idea about how do we actually engage people then? In what way, in which perspective do we engage them? The Russians have complained about this for now a generation, since the dissolution of the Soviet Union, that they are always approached from the perspective of assuming they're trying to get back to Soviet glory and not being allowed to carve out a new path, not being allowed to carve out a new global position that can reflect new power and new power projection. I wonder sometimes if China feels that same way in the way that the United States deals with it or its fellow regional neighbors, or simply it's just that case of when you're that big and that powerful, that age-old adage that's sort of a criticism of the military usually is that we don't want you always developing new weapons, because if you develop new weapons, inevitably you're going to be tempted to do what? To use them. Because we just don't have real pretty shiny new toys and stick them in the closet. We like to take them outside and show it off. And I wonder sometimes if that's just the innate problem in some of these discussions. Because again, if you remember back at the very beginning of this talk, and I'll conclude on this so we have more time for questions, the United States, I'll say, really does believe that even though it has its own national interests, even though it pursues its own agenda and objectives, without question, all around the globe, it still always offers this concurrent sort of running alongside it rhetoric of, but what we're doing is also good for the global community. And we really are motivated for good to be done. I'm fascinated by it. I wish more studies would be done on it, because I've come over time to believe that most of the people in the corridors of power in D.C. actually believe that, while no one else in any corridor of power I've ever found anywhere on earth even remotely believes that for a second. And so the disconnect in that overarching final competing narrative is really quite damaging, because it just simply means we never actually really talk. There is no real dialogue. It's just, okay, it's your turn. Say something. I'm not really paying attention. I'm not really listening. Okay, you're done? Okay, now I'm going to talk, and I know you're not really listening, and I know you aren't really paying attention. Okay, are you done? Okay, come back at me again. And we all hit our points, and we hit our buzzwords, and we hit our talking issues, and then we go back to our countries and tell our own people why it was not a success. The one small caveat of positivity I'll offer is that if this is indeed, at least in the South China Sea right now, a battle of competing narratives, I think it's at least safe to say that a battle of hostile words is still going to always be far better than a battle of violent bodies. And so far it hasn't emerged or elevated to that level, and hopefully it will always stay that way. As long as people keep talking, even if they're not listening, there's a small chance of hope someone might actually hear it one day. Thank you very much. This is a always we say, we need a cork popper, someone who's willing to pop the cork on the bottle, and then everyone else will come up.
Based on what I've heard about you say about how both countries are stockpiling arms, trying to develop the new best weapons and kind of just be the new, like, the biggest dog in the park, would you say that we're almost in a second Cold War?
It's funny you asked that question, because I was thinking of this morning, whether is that ultimately where we're meant to be heading? Right? Will it be a, now it's not Soviet, it's not Russia, America, it's Chinese America, this own Cold War. The only reason I'm hesitant, I don't believe that's the case, is only because of that issue of economic interdependence, in the sense that there's so many purse strings connecting the two countries that open hostile non-war war, which is kind of like what the Cold War is, could be potentially damaging to the economic thing. And both of these countries, no matter what they might say within their diplomatic corps or within their military corps, both of these countries care very, very deeply about their global economic positioning, perhaps most of all. And they don't want to see that damaged in any particular way.
How would you see in my opinion, I see there's like a clear difference between like who's providing who versus based on like most of the U.S. products are made in China. So how would the Chinese...
Do not mess with my Walmart. that word interdependence means a lot, because it isn't just, the manufacturing base may indeed be in China. The consumer base still is largely powered by the United States, by the consumerate, for lack of a better term, in the United States. I've often said this, that the only real true worry I would have in terms of the global economy in the United States is if any of these countries can actually rise up to the point where their people buy as much useless stuff as we do. There's the classic, I don't know how many people, I'm definitely dating myself now, but it's worth, forgive the vulgarity of it. If you remember George Carlin as a comedian, if you don't know, look him up, and don't blame me for the swear words. I will deny it. He always said the essence of America is basically what? We just want stuff. And there's this classic monologue of, why do we get a job? We get a job to make money. We make money, why? Because we want to buy stuff. Well, and we buy stuff, what do we purchase a house. Why? Because we need a place to put our stuff. And eventually we sell our house and move to a bigger house. Because we're successful? No. Because we want to move up with it? No. Because we have so much stuff, we need a bigger house to put all our stuff in. That is, in fact, one of the profound truths of America to me. And that, while it often is used today in a pop culture sense as a criticism of the American people, I think people underestimate just how politically powerful that one fact is, that Americans buy so much more than everyone else. That's always going to make them a sort of important linchpin in this global economic system. China is actually, I think, I don't know if they see it necessarily in those terms, but it is certainly trying to develop a consumer base, a purchasing power base, equal to the United States. But it still has a ways to go. So for now, that manufacturing base isn't, to me, in some ways as powerful as the consumer purchasing base.
Thank you.
What's the difference between the THAAD system to that of the Israeli anti-defense system, the Iron Dome?
Do you mean, hopefully you're not asking me to get into like deep scientific technical aspects of the two systems, or is it more, I just want to know more, are you coming from sort of the philosophical perspective of why one's allowed and one isn't? Or
yeah, more of the philosophical and also economically. So, why can't the South Koreans develop its own anti-defense military system to that of, like, the Israelis? The Israelis developed its own anti-defense system, the Iron Dome, to prevent deterrence from, like, Hamas and the Palestinians.
Right.
So why can't the South Koreans, rather than having, you know, deployments from, you know, the United States, why can't they create their own defense system? Because they have the technology, they have the capital, obviously. So
That's a fantastic question that has so many angles. I'm going to probably confuse myself right now in trying to answer it. There's a couple things involved. in the simple sense that Israel has always, obviously Israel has a different neighborhood, and one that obviously you could at least ostensibly argue is in a more hostile neighborhood toward itself, but also maybe bigger as a structural factor to me is the fact that there isn't a large dominant power in Israel's neighborhood that would be very against it developing its own system. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Whereas South Korea does have that, in this case being China. But not to blame it all on China, because another aspect of that, which still ends up with the same end result, is I wouldn't be shocked, even if they technically denied it openly in public, that the United States is always very interested in maintaining these types of relations, quote-unquote, where there's kind of a military materiel dependency by countries, which it may be originally wanted to also have with Israel, but Israel just simply said, listen, we have too many people around us that want to kill us. I don't really care what. We're going to take everything you give us, and then we're going to capitalize on it, and we're going to evolve it, and we're going to make new stuff out of it too. And if you don't like it, too bad. And we've had sometimes issues with some of that, where everyone likes in the Arab world would like to always say Israel does whatever the United States says. I think the United States wishes that was the case, because the United States will often have a whole laundry list of times where Israel didn't do what the United States said and is pretty angry about it. Whereas in South Korea, so there could be this angle of the greater power to the north that would not want them to see them have this sort of great independent military materiel producing capability. The person that the other big bad power that's supplying them with that materiel is also kind of motivated to keep them materiel-wise dependent on that market and on that infrastructure. And then there might even be, to make it even more complex and less satisfying as an answer to you probably, I wouldn't be surprised if there's even an internal Korean audience that says, if we can have this and we know how to work with it, we have the talent and the personnel to be experts in, say, for in this case, the THAAD system, why bother developing our own, right? In the sense that that's not real. The issue isn't a point of controversy for South Korea, whether or not it should develop its own system or use the United States system. It's having the system, period, is the great consternation for China, at least. So I don't know. It wouldn't solve their problems, and it might. I could see some audiences within South Korea saying, us developing our own capabilities independent of the United States so that we don't have to rely on them at all, A, might not resolve any of our present problems we have, but B, might also create some new problems at the moment we don't have. So I think we'll just stay away from it, and there's that status quo word again. We'll keep the status quo where it is because it doesn't solve any of our new problems.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
You've been listening to a lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard a talk by Matthew Crosston, professor of political science at Bellevue University, Miller Endowed Chair for Industrial and International Security, and director of the International Security and Intelligence Studies Program at Bellevue University. He spoke on the topic THAAD Mad Bad, the Battle of Competing Narratives Over the South China Sea. This program, part of the 12th Annual Asian Culture Week, co-sponsored by Creighton's Asian World Center, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday afternoon, April 19th, 2016, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, and Marang Jang, Director of Creighton's Asian World Center, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 600 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.